not talking about masonry necessarily. We're talking about people who have like basically used that as an infiltration device and have developed like, their own interpretations of things. I mean, I'm not saying Albert Pike was a great man, and that I mean, I don't know. I'm not, I see the value. It's synchronicity. Like, you look at Morals and Dogma, it's just like this syncs to this syncs to this, and there's incredible leaps and bounds that get made, and some of it I completely take with a grain of salt, and some of it I actually think is pretty logical. It has its value, and a lot of Masons are really fucking good people who just build. A lot of them don't even really, I mean, they'll participate in the rituals to a degree, but they're more interested in building shit, I mean, and who do we have to thank for a lot of the structures that are around, like, especially like government structures, obviously, but fucking post office and all sorts of things, And it's like, I don't have anything against Masonry. Like, I have an issue with the Bavarian Illuminati and, like, what some of their goals apparently were that came out in, like, Proofs of a Conspiracy all the way back in the late 1700s, like 1798, Proofs of a Conspiracy, the John Robinson book came out, and that shows that, okay, you're dealing with these people who have infiltrated Masonry as a means to get their agenda going. But I feel like it's just, I'm not down with taking an entire group of people who have a certain,
Oh no, yeah,
it's like, that's ridiculous.
I think this, and this is something even Frater X, who's also in Sync Book 2, he makes this point regularly, is that there's nothing inherently evil about Masonry and a lot of this esoteric knowledge and the study of it, and even the some of the secret societies that are founded around it. There's nothing inherently wrong with them. He's taking the position that there was an infiltration, and if you read Morals and Dogma, Albert Pike says very clearly, we want to institute a sort of chaos and conflict out of which we can take control. He says it very plainly.
Oh yeah, a lot of these things he says very straight up. That's why I say there's Albert Pike,
Right,
who
there's the
has his general
Scottish Rite.
Christ.
Yeah,
Yeah.
there's Albert Pike and the Scottish Rite, and then there's Masonry as a whole institution or a whole history. And that, I think we need to make that distinction. It's an important point.
I
Right.
agree. And I use Freemasonry as my plain example of the occult in effect with society and governments. And I did not expect the fear that came, afterwards. Like, I've never been like this guy who's standing on a soapbox saying Freemasons are Satanists and all of this. It was just they were the most open example of the occult influencing government, and so they were a good example of what was going on. But yeah, then everybody's just looking for an easy bad guy to blame, and I'm like, wait, who designed your nation? Who were your founding fathers? If you're gonna love America, you can't hate Freemasonry. I'm sorry. And that's why I brought Frater X to the front. I was like, come on, get on the show. And so I gave him the free zone for a while to get his start. And now, he's doing his own stuff. And that freaked everybody out because, they're like, I thought you were anti-Mason. I'm like, man, I got all kinds of Mason friends. I'm trying to show you that life is bigger than you think. And I'm just using them as an example. And not trying to, because this genre of radio that we're in now, the conspiracy talk show, if you will, was really founded by Christian patriots. And
Exactly, yeah.
so everybody's used to that kind of rhetoric, and they expect people to be standing on some sort of soapbox or another.
Well, that's kind of my point, is like I feel like, all this since there is this heavy Christian influence, and I'm not anti-Christian just as much as I'm not anti-Masonry, if which are actually those two are heavily intertwined more than they realize themselves, but
Oh yeah.
not that either side would want to admit that readily, but there's this idea that the Christian influence, I see a lot of people taking conspiracy points of view which are purely based on Christian dogma, and it's not, there's no real backing. It's just like this is bad, look at these people worshiping this symbol, and it's like, well, actually, you worship the same symbol. I love to give the example of people say a serpent. It's like, well, if you look in the Bible, they're comparing Jesus to a serpent. It's the serpent that heals. And they're saying how Jesus needs to be raised up like a serpent, and all this sort of stuff. How Jesus is Lucifer. You know, so like people say, it's a Luciferian agenda. It's like, well, you already are a Luciferian.
Yeah, it just means light, buddy. Sorry.
So I do think this is like a really important thing that I like to approach, but I feel like I've done a lot of stuff where I'm doing if I'm being interviewed on some show, and then I could say certain things and be like, oh, yeah. And then you say something, and they're like, whoa, what? You know, like, and it's like, oh, so you're a Satanist, or you're, it's like, no, I'm just, so there, I feel like there is this really heavy Christian influence that we need to discuss, and I think it's hard, because there's a lot of people get really defensive about it, but that's why I brought up the idea of seeing things where there also seems to be this promoted anti-Masonic agenda. As much as there's a promoted Masonic agenda, there's a promoted anti-Masonic agenda. And it definitely, there's this really heavy influence there that needs to be recognized. Freeman, I want to ask you a question. I know Fraterex told me right after you had him on the first time, a bunch of conspiracy radio hosts did like some sort of emergency radio broadcast saying, we've suspected Freeman of being disinfo for a long time, and now he's proven himself. Do you know what he's talking about? I don't remember what that was, but...
I don't want to point any fingers.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I don't actually know.
Yeah, but... I didn't mean to put... I wasn't trying to start like a beef or anything. I just meant...
But this is another critical point, though, is because everybody wants to disbelieve everybody, and you can debunk anything and everything on the internet. But we're so paranoid now that anyone that's out there trying to do any help for you, you know, it's like, oh, he can't have altruistic means, you know, or purposes. There's obviously an agenda. And man, you know, it's like, damn, I'm just trying to enjoy this and share and you know, gain knowledge and share knowledge. And yeah, you know, but if I were to sit back and just, you know, agree with or listen to all my YouTube comments, I'd probably be up in a hole somewhere, you know, shaking or something, because everybody's so awful. But, you know, there's such a small percentage. It's just that on the internet, it makes it look like they're huge because they've got the biggest quote or something, you know.
They write with the biggest letters.
Yeah. The most, but there again, it's because you wanted, you know, people want people on a soapbox. They want people pointing fingers at their enemy, and they want someone that's a tool for them. You know, and this is, I've been thinking about this a lot, the martyr complex, the thing that might be programmed through the Jesus mythos, the idea that we need one person to go and sacrifice themselves for us. I mean, this is why Alex Jones makes $400,000 on one of his money bombs. You know, people don't just give Alex money. They want a tool. They're like, okay, Alex is our tool. He's out there saying all the things we want to say, and he's causing and stirring all the problems we want to stir. So let's pay our martyr to do it for us.
Sure. You always see those comments, oh, I hope one day, like, you know, Ron Paul is going to get assassinated if he becomes president. Oh, Alex Jones is going to get off by the government if he says too much information. It's like, as someone said, they want him to be the martyr, so they want him to die.
So
that would prove the whole thing to them. You know, it's like, if he dies, then everything, all this energy that I've invested into this philosophy is real. It's definitely there. But then there's the aspect that, like, Alex Jones has been on The View. You know, Jesse Ventura on The View, like, with Barbara Walters. Like, that's bizarre to me. You know, so the fact that, like, there is this sort of mainstream conspiracy, I don't know, you know, it's like the approved conspiracy, the acceptable conspiracy theory is put out there.
Well, and it's the mindset that's put out there. You know, they want people reactionary. They want everybody in their fight or flight. And anyone that's projecting that type of fearmonger is what they're going to promote.
I'm sure you guys are familiar with what happens when you try and like take your master thesis and put everything in its place and try and like arrange your knowledge base on factors, and you'll find that things tend to, your understanding of things tend to change. And as soon as you like, I mean, I just like looking at my chapter for the Sync Book 2, I'm already like, is that the way I wanted to phrase that? Like, but it's out there and I release it and that's okay. But I can just recognize how easily, like, I can have some sympathy for some of these people who at one point in my life I would call disinformationalists. Like, I still feel the same way about, like, Sitchin or something, or just because there's a degree of it that you're like, okay, no, that's straight manipulation. But it's like, I set out with the intention to have all true information. I have a conversation with a friend last night, and we're talking about the scarab beetle, and I'm telling him, oh, yeah, I from my understanding, you can get psilocybin from the dung ball of a scarab beetle, and so that's interesting. It's a sacred symbol. He's like, no, actually, they used to feed psilocybin to the larger scarabs and then collect their shit and make tea out of it. And they basically did the same thing that was done with like reindeer with Amanita muscaria, where the reindeer eat the Amanita muscaria and then they would literally drink the piss that was in the snow. They'd drink the snow in order to get high off it because it would process the thing and make it more easy to to take. And so I'm like, wow, that's like a little bit of he could be wrong, I could be wrong, we could both be wrong, but like whenever you're dealing with this information, this kind of information, it's like so easy to have something that's not entirely accurate. And even if you set out and try, like, you're just working to try and put everything fact-based, like, you look at your work fucking 3 years from now and you'll totally find like a slew of things that you're like, well, that's not entirely correct. And you're like, well, that was, but at the time you were pretty sure of it, you'd done research and whatever. And so, like, I don't know, I can definitely recognize that just because somebody's wrong about something doesn't mean that they're evil or that they're trying to manipulate or they have this alternative agenda.
Yeah, but then I would propose the solution to that problem, because I've experienced that myself. You're absolutely right. But I think the solution to this is to put a question mark, a hanging question mark on things, to say, this is what I think, this is where the research seems to point, and to admit when you don't fucking know. There's exactly a difference between getting on the radio and shouting, go get your guns and fight these guys, you know, and instigating some sort of violence and very, very reactionary thing. Now, again, he could be very well intentioned. Like,
listen, you're talking about Alex Jones specifically.
Well, no, I don't even mean to be specific, but let's just say, listen, I know when I was in the hardcore paranoid viewpoint, it's like, all right, well, if this is real, I want to do something about it. So I understand that perspective. Like, I totally get that. And at the same time, I think once things get weird enough, which is, I think, why I'm much more comfortable in this territory, which is to say, no, things are a lot stranger than that. Right. You know, Alex Jones, just give Alex Jones as the example, and not to, I really don't mean to single him out, but just to say, like, he did a thing in the last few months, which was, like, about the clockwork elves, and he's like, they believe this, look, they are crazy, and they're, and it's like, well, hold on, can we step back and say there is a long history of a phenomenon? So even like with the Gnomemobile, you know, movie as the example I was giving, so it's like, even if a Mason contacted an elf or a gnome or a reptilian or anything, that doesn't take away from the thousands of years of history of other people talking about similar things. You know, you have fairy lore. It was not invented by the Illuminati. It's a very integral part of the human experience is to talk about these other realms. So to like get on the radio and shout, oh my God, look, they believe this, which is not what we believe, because we believe in Jesus and Ron Paul. Hey, they believe in elves and serpents and something else, and we got to get up guns and fight them, I think is very irresponsible. I think
Well, that's another level to what. Yeah. I mean, that's the extreme example of something where you're like, okay, well, as soon as you are suggesting, like, as soon as you bring, like, anger into a reactionary thing, you've kind of ceased to, you've steered your investigation in the direction of, like, you've pulled out the jump to conclusions board and you're literally jumping to conclusions. Like, that's a whole other level, you know? It's just like, I was saying, like, wow, it is tough to, with this type of information, to actually, like, get it all and get it right. Like,
yeah, geez. It's so hard. I agree. And I think, as I said, yeah, I feel like that's the responsible thing to do then, is to say, you know, this is what I think, but I don't know. This is the best It's the best answer I've come to.
Yeah, I wanted to like put a disclaimer at the beginning of my chapter, being like, I'm going to spout out a bunch of shit, and I think it's all true. And feel free to contact me or do whatever you need to do if you find anything that you like that doesn't align with your understanding, and show me why. You know, it's just, I'm putting something out there, and I'm putting my name to it, and it's just like, I don't know. I feel very much like, okay, I feel like this is all correct, but I don't absolutely know with all of it, you know.
Kevin, what were you gonna say?
I think that's an interesting thing, because like currently, like who I am right now is kind of descended from that like accusatory level of understanding that comes with conspiracy awareness, and so the fact conspiracies, like, it led me to need to understand history and believe, like, what mysticism and magic and astrology and, like, how any of this actually had any power and play in the universe. So when I stuff, I realized, like, oh, wow, this is really, like, you know, into our life, and, you know, it is the universe around us. So I think that's part of the interesting thing, is that I want to be clear to me to actually engage with becoming a mage or whatever, you know. So I think that's the process that the universe is putting all of, like, if everyone wants to serve truth and everyone has goodwill, then, like, even when we get excited about certain things, our reaction puts something out there and it allows the world to redirect that. So, like, these Gnostic traditions have, and, you know, magical traditions have been going on since the beginning of time. Public is starting to react to them adversely, but I think what actually will happen is that more clarity about them will, and people like myself will actually find themselves inspired to re-engage these Gnostic traditions and like enrich them with, you know, more searching for truth, you know. So I almost feel like the Gnostic current is actually what working everybody, including Christians and everybody. It's like that current wants attention, and it's going to put Masons and some of these other people through different degrees of scrutiny, but I think in the end of it, you know, current itself is natural. It's all about picking and choosing what is really appropriate, I think, you know, and like that's where we've got to draw lines and step back from, you know, the accusatory role sometimes, but also be more specific when we are being accusatory. But, you know, in the end, I think it's all a service to this truth that's trying to speak for itself, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, there's this idea, I think what's, to speak to the Gnostic position for a minute, is there seems to be some duality in that as well, where it's saying there are negative influences, there are these, you know, archons, there is this sort of, you know, controlled matrix-like environment, and yet there's also an element of truth. And so, like, to be able to have, you know, to be able to have both, or to recognize both, that there are elements of manipulation, and yet there's something at the core that's true and beautiful that ultimately can't be manipulated.
Right. That's the amazing thing, is that conspiracy makes clear to us when people are like misusing their magic or their connection to the universe or their creative power. It becomes clear through, you know, one way or another, that something is not aligned and it stands out. But like, what we notice is all the actual good and true magic that, you know, creates technologies and institutions with higher values, and, you know, everything's magical operations. So even when I see, you know, the dark side appearing through some of this stuff, it's like that's actually just the limits that are standing out to us, because a lot of what humanity does is very harmonious in certain ways, so we're not going to perceive it as like a mystical conspiratorial thing, even though it actually still kind of is in a way, you know.
Totally.
Well, I gotta admit that I'm gonna have to sign off here really shortly. I've been on all morning radio, and then I have another one tonight with Clyde Lewis, so.
Oh, not a problem. Thanks for joining us, Freeman. Appreciate it. It's good chatting with you.
Yeah, totally. It was fantastic, guys.
Yeah, pleasure to chat, man.
I'm so looking forward to reading all of Sync Book 2.
Totally. You're awesome, man. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
The book is really good. Like, I have to say, it is. I'm really, really happy with it. And I think I'm one of a handful of people that have read it so far. It's just me and a few other people who worked on the editing and putting the book together with me. But it's good. So I think everyone's going to be really, really happy. And I can't wait till you guys who contributed are actually get a chance to see it and hold it in your hands.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So excited. Thank you for this opportunity and thanks for everything.
Right back at you. Thank you, brother. Be well. Talk to you soon, okay?
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Peace, man.
So, Kevin, you're live from the Logosphere. That's your deal?
Yeah.
Dude, I gotta say, man, like, your blog had a really big impact on me, to say the least. I loved your, what was it, two years ago or whatever it was, like, the down the rabbit hole 42 business really impacted me. And I can say that I drew upon it in my chapter at different points, you know, and I never mentioned your name, but I figured it was a given within the Sync community. Like, people recognize where some of those things came from, you know, and I, in order to move on with to follow through with a thought, sometimes I had to include some of the things that I believe came out of your own set of connections. And I like, you did that one with the beetle, the scarab and the Volkswagen, and you point out the Vav thing with, you could take Vav as 666, right? If you look at the right. W and the V, and that Vav is Wah also when you intone it. And so,
oh yeah, yeah.
All these ideas, like, were really helpful in my whole experience. And yeah, I definitely, like, I really love your work.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
As all of ours.
Right. It's a whole community thing. But yeah, the way you
really,
you,
like, I think that's, you
systematically
part
laid
of
the situation
thing. So it's cool.
Totally.
And it's cool, you know, like,
shoot, you're breaking up.
It's weird. Like, I kind of, I wish I had that much time these days, but I'm breaking up again. But yeah, no, it's, I really appreciate hearing that from you, because, you know, I don't always have the time to go back to it or to see, and it's just cool to hear that it's, you know, harmonious and inspirational to others, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's out there at this point. So even if you're not putting up new stuff, you were pretty prolific for quite a while. And it's all still there. And, like, it wasn't, like, as it was happening, it was too much for me to actually be able to, like, go through and look at all of it. So the fact that it's up now, and you can, it's still, at any point, you can still go over these different things. It's pretty cool.
So. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely, like, just amazing to see, like, how quickly, like, I don't know. It's crazy. Like, when I was really had a lot more time to blog and, like, read and other stuff, I was, I remember just, like, waiting for podcasts and, like, being really excited for the next Sync video. And, like, now I've got, like, bookmark lists that go, like, weeks where I'm, you know, more podcasts than I can listen to. And it's, like, it's just so amazing to see, like, how much, you know, access and, like, enrichment is possible right now through everybody. So, It's really cool to see.
Awesome. Yeah, it was something that was coming up, been repeatedly coming up, and me and Alan have discussed at length. I believe it was you who put up a post quite a while back about the serious dog, so with 9/11. So there was, like, a fire dog or something, and they had this whole...
Thank you. I wanted to ask him about that, too.
Yeah, it's just, it's huge. And so, like, that's been coming up regularly. And I was tripping out on the fact that you have these two towers that appear on the moon card in the rider deck in Tarot, where you have this, like, you have a wolf on one side and a dog on the other, and then you have these towers. And when you look at the Crowley deck, you have these two towers, obviously, but then you have Anubis standing there in front of him, the double Anubis. And so that's like, obviously, like you were relating that to Sirius. You have Sirius connected with the two towers in the moon card, with the scarab at the bottom. You have your beetle, right? In Crowley's deck. But then those same two towers reoccur in the death card, right. But the death card originally had no title in the Marseille Tarot. And so, and the way they appear with the rising sun between them, and you see the sun rising between them in the death card, and then you're like, you have the beetle rising up in the moon card. And then I was looking at the fact that you have the sun is related to Resh, the Hebrew letter, which means the front of the head, which I was taking to be the pituitary gland between the eyes. And then you, the moon is actually literally the back of the head, which you could easily take as the most medial point in the back of the, or, you know, the core of the brain being the pineal gland. And so the relationship between the pituitary and the pineal, it then becomes a relationship between the sun and the moon card. And I did an experiment where I overlaid the sun and the moon of the Crowley deck with 50-50 transparency. And it's fascinating the way that the scarab ends up landing there with Cancer. Like, Cancer becomes at the bottom of the card because he has the zodiac around in a circle, and right, then obviously right. You have the crustacean in the Rider deck is what's coming out of the water in that exact same spot. And, and so, like, it's like that was like a trip. Like, I was like, wow. And so that, and so I was trying to tie that in with the whole 9/11 thing. And it's fascinating what happens when you take the Roman numerals of 9 and 11 and you put them together and you extend the lines. You can basically make a Star of David from the 9/11 Roman numerals, which is really fascinating. You can also do the same thing with George Lucas's THX symbol. If you mirror it upon itself and then extend out the lines, you can basically generate this the Star of David. And so that's just interesting on the same line of logic, because you have the reconciliation of the Tree of Life generates this star. You have a perfect vector metric that you can produce. And so anyways, I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Cutting out again. Damn.
I forgot what I was looking at recently with 9/11. There was something. Oh, poo. Hang on.
There was a guy.
This used to happen, like, whenever I'm doing this stuff.
There was a guy that was just on Red Ice recently, and he was dropping, like, all this old school 9/11 info. And didn't even credit at all, but this is, so I don't know if that's what you're, because me and Will Morgan were talking about this, how this guy totally ripped off your serious stuff and didn't even.
Yeah, and it was funny, I noticed that too, and he kind of did that thing that we were talking about where, you know, he just kind of skipped, he actually skipped the details that were highly synchronistic, you know, and just kept to, like, what was relative occult conspiracy, and yeah, it felt like that was a little, you know, a little funny, but I mean, you know, that's what the stuff is there for. Everyone can, like, grab at it and make their mind up, you know, but. He omitted, like, the particulars of date, you know, being like, I think it was 4/24/2002 that they held the Rainbow Bridge ceremony for the dog. And, you know, the big thing there is that there's, like, 342s in that date, and, you know, the dog when Tower Wiz was filmed, and all this, you know, there's all this context dog and Sirius, and so to me, there's this mystical architecture that's just embedded in that, you know, like, due to the composure of the universe, not in intentions. You know? So he just kind of took a symbol, which was just those kind of universal glyphs, and just sticking with the, you know, the holding. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, this is again my same problem. It's like, you can't just say, oh, and then this encodes Sirius, and you know Sirius is something very important to the occult people, so this is proof of an occult conspiracy. It's like, why don't you tell me, what does Sirius mean? Because you don't fucking know. Yeah. You either don't know or you don't want to say. Because,
torture?
What's that?
Torture? Scorch, yeah. Literally.
Oh,
I mean, that's how Sirius translates.
Sorry. I thought you were saying torture.
Scorcher. Yeah.
Yes, torture. Scorch. No, yeah, but I mean, yeah. Like, what is, if you're going to say Sirius has this occult significance, why go into what is the occult significance? You can't say this is proof of an occult conspiracy. Why don't you say, what does Sirius actually mean? You know, and then, because right. the thing is, when you actually go into what these things mean, it gives you paints a completely different picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I was at the ceremony I did. There was this dog, this black dog wandering around. So, you know, I had this ayahuasca experience, and there was this dog there. And it was totally like he was the guide through the underworld. Like, I looked at this dog, and it was like the dog lived at the house where this happened at regularly, you know. And I'm like, this dog is like, he's like here as the guide. Like, I felt that, you know, and I'm whatever. That was in my own mind, in my own projection, but it was perfect at the time, you know. So that dog had an occult significance to me. He was the boat, you know. He was carrying me through it, you know, or at least part of that, you know. So.
That's cool.
It's so funny you mentioned the black dog, because I've been wanting to mention, has anyone seen Richard Arrowsmith's new video?
No.
Richard Arrowsmith, who blogs as Black Dog Star, he just put up a new video all about Quetzalcoatl and the serpent. And it's super sinky. I mean, you know, well, that's obvious, but it's good. It's really good. But like the timing of it is just, it generated a whole host of personal sinks. Like, I only went to his video channel because I was linking to it, or I was linking something about serpents and then him, and then went to his video channel just to link and saw Richard Arrowsmith just put up a new video, and it was all about the serpents, and it's just like really crazy. And then watching it, and it was completely in line with something else I had just watched, and it's just, well, whatever. So I've been wanting, we've talked about serpents a number of times throughout this show today. I was wondering if anyone had seen this. So check out Richard Arrowsmith, Black Dog Star. He's also in Sync Book 2. I love his videos. He put up a new one. It's like 40. It's not 42 minutes long. It's like 41 minutes and something seconds. But check out his new video. Not like right this minute. I'm just throwing that out. For whoever's listening, please check out Richard Arrowsmith's new video.
Totally. The 42-letter name in Hebrew is such a huge part of Hebrew, of Jewish mysticism. And, you know, it's just like I don't know if you've studied that at all, Kevin, but it fits in so perfectly. It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, basically the 42 word prayer that's written in the Tefillin cube that go on your hand and on your head, you know, they take the 42 letter name and they attribute one letter to every word of the prayer. And they have this whole thing around 42, and that this is what the aspirant is told to meditate on at the moment of death, which is so fascinating that you point out like the Sri Yantra thing with the 42 triangles, because that's also, you know, the Indians are told to meditate on this at the moment of death. And so, and then obviously you have to meditate on the 42 principles of Ma'at at the moment of death. And so, I mean, that's a pretty heavy duty sink, like more so than I think anybody may have realized when we first got into, you know, the classic Douglas Adams 42, you know, idea. Like, that's pretty fucking far out.
And I really love, I studied the prayer for a while. Not recently, I really do want to go back to it, but I do remember, like, the first couple of lines referring to basically, you know, calling upon the Most High to untie untie the bindings of the people. And I thought that was really interesting, just that, like, you know, the prayer calls on God via the 42 name, and kind of the way 42 is so connected with synchronicity, like synchronicity seems to kind of like untie some of the worries and like fears of knowing whether or not you're in the right place, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, I feel like sync is really affirmative and like healing in that way. So for it to connect with the intention of that prayer to kind of like untie the binds, you know, I thought that was a pretty cool dimension to that too.
Sure. Yeah, it's basically starts out the Behold Israel, the Lord is one. Basically to let, and this is so misunderstood, I think there's, it's like what they mean, you know, by Adonai, Adahenu, Adonai, Achad. So Achad is one, it's unity, right? So you're basically acknowledging God is one, like, which means that all of the, and since everything is the expression of God, that everything is one. And so here, right. Israel, everything is one. You're like, it, then they take that as like, Israel is one. It's like, no, you're not in unity against the rest of the world. Right. You're in unity with the world.
Israel is the world.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Like, you're one with the world. And so, and that's God. And so it's just this very simple, like, get this point. And then you hold that at the tefillin cube, which is at your forehead. So it's like at your temple, like you're to recognize that everything is one, and you're taking that and you're connecting it with your hand. And then, like earlier, you had mentioned the what is it called, ahimsa, the hand with the eye in it, right? The symbolism of that connects directly to the 42-letter name and the tefillin cube, because they have this whole thing in Kabbalah where the hand has 28 segments total, the two hands. So you have 14 segments per hand. Like if you look at your digits, right? So you have these 14 digits. But then right. there's this whole thing with Rosicrucianism where the cube of space has 14 surrounding segments. So if you unfold the cube of space to make the Rosicrucian cross, you have these 14 segments. And so the cube of space and the hand are held as one. And so you have Yud means the open hand, whereas Kaf means the closed hand. So you have 10 and you have 20. You have 1 and 0 and you have 2 and 0. You have the monad and you have the duad. And you have a closed hand and an open hand expressed through that. The duad becomes a closed hand. The monad is the open hand. Like, it's so straightforward. And then that's the cube of space. And we're all on this cross. And so you have the essence of the rose is held within the cross. And so this is like, so like this is like foundational symbolism that is so simple and straightforward, yet remains so misunderstood.
Yeah, totally.
What do you make of the fact that we also have the mythology of Osiris cut into 14 pieces?
Yeah, same fucking thing, completely. And so we have a whole that's divided. We have like a like our we are that, right? I mean the phallus is our own phallus. Like when you look at what's being spoken of, right, it's being divided and spread throughout the world, right? I mean, that's how I received the idea of Set dividing Osiris. I mean, it's ourselves, right? It's our own fractured identity, which you need to bring together as one, because that's Adonai. It's not Adonai until it's one, like.
Right. And then people talk about like the Saturn cube. This idea of you're saying this is the cube that's separated into 14 segments. It's again, it's the same thing, since Osiris is Saturn.
There's also 14, I believe it's exactly 14. No, it might be 16. I think it's 16 court cards in the tarot. But those kind of make up the personality, so I thought that might have been an interesting...
you're talking about the royal card or something? Is that what it is? Yeah. Four.
Yeah, it's 4x4, so yeah, it would be 16.
Mm-hmm. That's been coming up too in a major way. There was a recent post from Jake Kotza, and I should know. Basically, the most recent post in the sinkhole I looked briefly at, but it was talking about One-Eyed Jack. And then I immediately type in One-Eyed Jacks, and I get a film that was supposed to be directed by Stanley Kubrick called One-Eyed Jacks, but ended up being directed by Marlon Brando. It's this Western, really interesting. But then I was like, the One-Eyed Jack, which are the One-Eyed Jacks in a playing deck? And it's like, oh, the Jack is, first of all, the hearts and I believe the spades. So you have the swords and the cups of the pages. So the page in the Rider deck becomes the princess in Crowley's deck. So you have the princess of cups and the princess of hearts are the are taken to be the One-Eyed Jacks. And I found it interesting that the princess of swords and the princess of cups. And so, but the princess of swords is described as, when Crowley's talking about the energetic of that card, he's talking about Moses coming down from Sinai and seeing the people worshiping the golden calf, and that the energetic of that is what is the hostility that the princess is facing, like in the card. Like, I thought that was really an interesting take on it, because you have entering down from Aries, obviously, you have the ram's horn, Moses, you know, descends and then sees everybody worshiping the previous age or worshiping, you know, the lower mind or however you want to take it. You know, it's like, right. That was really interesting in terms of the idea of the one-eyed Jack. And then obviously I go and think about the Shining immediately with Jack, and then that's a can of worms. But yeah.
What about, there's two one-eyed Jacks. There's also one one-eyed king, the King of Diamonds. And it makes me think of like this phrase, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
The Knight of Discs in Crowley's Tarot. So, let's see here, what does the Knight of Discs look like? Which is, oh, that's interesting. So the Knight of Discs, right, isn't that, that's Taurus. So you see, oh, no, wait a minute, no, I stand reflected. It's not, that's another one. That's the Prince of it. No, so that's the only Knight card of Crowley's, which it, has the knight not in movement. It's the only knight where the knight is still, and he's just on his horse, and there's like a sunrise behind him, and the horse is like feeding on the wheat, which is interesting because his argument for making the knight in the first place to take the place of the king is because he was saying that you have this king who's on a throne who's just kind of sitting there. And he is making the argument that change is the basis for stability and not the other way around. So we have to embrace change in order to be stable, which is a paradox, right? It's like if you're looking for that plateau where you no longer have to do any work, they see that as, you know, they had seen that as like, that's the goal, right? Is to not do anything. And he was saying what we've learned, at least this is how I interpret it, what we've learned as a culture with like our American dream and our Western dream, right, is that isn't actually any reality. You never get to a place where you just get to like be like, okay, now it's nothing, because there's like, you're ignoring the work that like the great work goes on and on to infinity's end. You don't reach a place right. where you're like, oh, now I can sit on my ass and watch TV. Like,
right.
And, but what's interesting is that the Knight of Discs is the one-eyed knight or the one-eyed king is the only one that's not in movement in Crowley's deck. Kind of weird.
Well, so Jason Barrera makes the point, like there's a David Bowie song, Bring Me the Head of the Disco King, and he makes this as the King of Discs, and he, you know, connecting this back to like John the Baptist and stuff like that. So Bring Me the Head is like somebody say, Bring Me the Head of John the Baptist, Bring Me the Head of the Disco King, the King of Discs. But I want to see if we could take this a little bit to Terrence McKenna's like Time Wave Zero. We're so close to the end of the time wave. You know, is this idea like the end of change, the end of novelty is at the end of change? Because the idea that change is the basis for stability is the Chinese philosophy of the I Ching. So, you know, we have here right now, we have a president whose logo is change. You know, Barack Obama, the whole change thing. So here we have that change is due to end. Or however you want to interpret that, what do you guys see happening with this, if anything? Because to me, it seems silly to think, it's particularly if you're basing something off the I Ching where it says change cannot stop.
Right. You shed the skin, so that's a change, and then there's a new beginning in the shedding, right? So you could take it in the serpent sense. That, you know, the Quetzalcoatl, the thing about Quetzalcoatl is he is the feathered serpent, right? Which means he's most high, as far as they're concerned. He soars through the sky, and then the serpent is the closest to the ground. So it's as above, so below, inherent in a single expression. And so for the serpent to shed its skin is basically like, yes, that change is the basis for it to be stable. Like it allows for the change, and then there's a new stability that comes out of it, right? I mean, that's one idea.
Yeah, I think another interesting thing in it, I can kind of tie it into even that King Kill springtime meme, which is just kind of that, like, if Terrence McKenna's theory is that, like, habit and novelty are reaching greater and greater frequencies of, you know, activity, and it hits infinity on December 21st, what I would perceive, and part of my kind of process in this whole kind of like new age realm of things, is that, like, you know, like I mentioned before, I started out as a conspiracy theorist, now I'm an occultist. Like, there's this kind of like 2012 in the beginning for everyone is this approach that the whole different than we ever thought that there's most that, you know, whole story. So approaching a state, everyone is changing the narrative, or at least seeing that there's another narrative for, you know, and like living this new narrative. They took on like the lunar calendars and, you know, all the, I think when the world actually doesn't end, novelty will hit infinity, because we will realize that we've never had any context for novelty or have it in the first place, because wait, this is also new and we always have to change what we believe about it. So like, I think that'll be the relationship after, you know, time is here, infinity, is that we'll the novelty of it, the only constant thing that we can carry. Or at least that's, I don't know, that's one way of looking at it for me. You know, it's just like access to new narratives, or at least an understanding of, is a, you know, a validity to those things.
I have here, if you guys permit me, I have a book I took out of the library a few weeks ago. It's Helmut Wilhelm, the guy who made I Ching so popular in the West, a series of lectures he gave on the I Ching typed out. And I just want to read like a really short passage. It says, "It is in constant change and growth." Oh, sorry. Let's just back that up a second. "Change is, quote, the begetter of all begetting, it is said, the overflowing abundance of the force which perpetually renews itself and for which there is never standstill nor cessation. It is in constant change and growth alone that life can be grasped at all. If it is interrupted, the result is not death, which is really only an aspect of life, but life's reversal, its perversion. This perception is highly characteristic of the Chinese concept of change. The opposite of change is neither rest nor standstill, for these are aspects of change. The idea that the opposite of change is regression and not cessation of movement brings out clearly the contrast with our category of time. The opposite of the opposite of change in Chinese thought is growth of that which ought to decrease, the downfall of what ought to rule. Change, then, is not simply movement as such, for its opposite is also movement. The state of absolute immobility is such an abstraction that the Chinese, or at least the Chinese of the period which produced this book, could not conceive it. Change is natural movement, rather, development that can only reverse itself by going against nature."
Yes! That's awesome. Wow. You know, there's an idea with yoga that yoga is actually against nature, you know, like to do any form of yoga is to go against the grain. Have you ever heard that before? It's like, that's why, like with asana, if you do an asana pose, you feel tension because you're going against the grain of force. You're like going backwards. But it's only in going back that, you know, basically you reach any kind of real equilibrium. You have to go against the grain.
Sure. Danny Torrance has to walk backwards out of the maze, out of the labyrinth.
Exactly. Completely.
I think there's That's a the natural... Thing I wanted to mention, but... Go ahead, Kev. Sorry.
I was just going to...
I don't know if Kevin's speaking and we can't hear him, or... Kevin, you there?
Is really the sun finally kind of conquers... Oh, can you hear it all?
We missed all of that.
Oh. Well, I was just tapping into the King Kill meme and the change in stability. You know, the interesting thing about this theme of a new, you know, new king usurping the old one in the spring, to me it kind of symbolizes the way that last year's sun is kind of the old king, and everything that it's created in nature is kind of the kingdom of the old sun. But in May, when the new brings new light to the earth, that's when a new king is kind of, the new light is technically having its kingship over the earth.
I thought it was so funny. Yesterday, Jim Sanders released a video about Denzel Washington, and he in it he sing you know he plays the Beatles song "Here Comes the Sun King."
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then of course there's obviously the George Harrison song "Here Comes the Sun." Well, I don't know if Jim realized this, but was that video released yesterday?
Yeah.
That's the anniversary of George Harrison's death.
Wow. You know, it's funny. I actually was putting the video on, and I realized my girlfriend was listening to acoustic blues covers of the Beatles by some guy who played in Wings. And suddenly Jim's video starts spanning blues music synchronicities, and then the Beatles came on in the video, and I was like, whoa. So I had my girlfriend playing the Beatles on one side of the room, and then, you know, Jim's video playing the blues and the Beatles. It was very funny.
You know, the Beatles as the Scarabs, which you pointed out, brought like, so I read that, and then this was a couple of years ago, and then I had an acid trip where all of a sudden I was just like, duh, dude, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, the Scarabs and the Dung Balls.
Oh, that's awesome.
And
that's
that they're so always cool. Playing off of each other.
Rock and roll, like
literally, laterally.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Cowadunga, dude.
Oh, that's so full circle. That's awesome.
Oh, man. So, you know, Harrison, just if I may, Harrison died in 2001, same year as 9/11, right? Same year as the Space Odyssey is obviously supposed to take place. There was an interesting little thing here. So we have the death of the old Sun King, if it's Here Comes the Sun and Here Comes the Sun King. So Harrison died yesterday, and then he plays Here Comes the Sun King. So it's like sort of like that death of the king, rebirth of the king. Very obvious there. But there was something, you guys on the Sinkhole had done this thing when Leslie Nielsen died.
Mm-hmm.
2001 A Space Travesty?
Right. Leslie Nielsen does a 2001 Space Travesty. He does all these sort of things, and you guys were playing up on this. Now, check this out. George Harrison died in 2001. He has an album called 33 and a Third. If you look at the album cover, you see this George Harrison wearing these sunglasses with this kind of like reflected glass over his face, which looks exactly like the cover to the movie poster to 2001, A Space Odyssey, where you see Dave Bowman with the reflection on his visor. Huh. So if you look at the 33 and a Third George Harrison album cover and compare it to the 2001 movie poster, you see that same reflected glass. Harrison dies in 2001. Now, Leslie Nielsen, who we know is 2001 A Space Travesty and all that sort of stuff, he'd made a movie called Naked Gun 33 and a Third. So
right.
So he also has 33 and a Third.
You know that the third on 33 and a Third is Ohm. You see that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's so awesome.
So Leslie Nielsen dies in the year 2010, which, of course, the sequel to 2001 A Space Odyssey is 2010, the year we make contact. The movie poster for The Year We Make Contact is The Space Baby. The movie poster to Leslie Nielsen's 33 and a Third has Leslie Nielsen pregnant as he's standing like doing the Demi Moore pose where she's standing naked and present, pregnant.
Ooh, dude, totally. Nice one.
Right? So you see that? That's...
Yeah. Okay, so George Harrison was supposed to be the star of Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain, which the reason why he was replaced was because he didn't want to show his asshole. And so,
right, because he's a Beatle. He's not a Rolling Stone.
Right. Totally. But I was just like, I don't know. I was thinking, I had stopped and I was considering like this, the symbolism of like, when you look at like, okay, Freud's idea of anality, he kind of like credited or whatever, because you're like, oh, if somebody like basically that our money, he has this association with money and anality, that basically the way we are when we're when we're very young and we're promorphously perverse, meaning our sexuality is everywhere and everything, like, which I completely resonate with. I don't agree with everything Freud has to say, but I think that when, like, our view of sexuality tends to be really limited in terms of what vitality means and what energy means. And I do not believe that our sexuality starts at puberty. I think that it's just, like, this is the idea of sublimation. Like, we sublimate our sexual energy through repression. And so, of course, you have, like, whatever you want to call it, like Mars or our base chakra, right? Everything gets repressed. And so this is like my idea of, like, not my personal idea, but this notion of the serpents like descending, and then the serpent is coiled at our base and basically is taking in the toxins and whatever, you know, and just usually doesn't ever get the chance to resurface, but people just go through their lives like that. You know, it's really interesting, like this kind of what you could take out of the symbolism of him not wanting to ascend the holy mountain because he has an issue with his anus, or that he doesn't want his anus exposed.
Yeah.
Do you get where I'm going with that? So I don't know.
I have a fear of the lower nature or something, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, I don't know. I thought that was, and I don't know. He's there with Maharishi, you know, doing his whole thing. And then you have obviously like all the levels of Rosemary's Baby and the Beatles' White Album, which we went into. I don't know if you heard any of that, Kevin.
No, I don't think I caught that.
I had my mind completely blown. Just like an experiment, I decided to play the Beatles' White Album with Rosemary's Baby, which was inspired by what I had found with Marilyn Manson's album Hollywood, and putting it with Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain. And only after I did that did I find out that Marilyn Manson was actually close friends with Jodorowsky. And Jodorowsky said that that album in particular was the album that defined him as an artist and this and that. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's something to this.
Cool.
But anyways, and then John Lennon was the secret producer of Holy Mountain. So the Holy Mountain wouldn't have ever been released if it wasn't for John Lennon stepping in and aiding that. So, oh, what's that?
He paid for the whole thing.
Yeah, he ended up paying
$1 million or something like that.
Yep, because, well, they got to the point where they weren't able to continue, and he was the one who came through and was like, here you go, you know, and didn't want any credit, but he did it, you know. And, you know, so anyways, I don't know. I was just going down that whole chain and realizing the symbolic significance there with Mr. Harrison.
Just for the record, I had that backwards. I don't know if you guys see the picture I just linked here. It's Leslie Nielsen that died on November 28th. It's George Harrison that died on November 29th. So they died a day apart. I mean, obviously 9 years and a day apart. And they're both born in February, which is interesting. They're both born in February, died in November. But just to correct myself, because again, making mistakes, we just want to correct ourselves. It was Nielsen who died on the 28th and Harrison who died on the 29th. Didn't you guys did your Rosemary's Baby Always Record episode on the day John Lennon died? No, John Lennon's birthday. Excuse me, John Lennon's birthday.
Oh, right. Was that it? Yeah, okay, yeah. And John Lennon's birthday is the day that the Torah starts over. So when Jews, you know, traditionally in all the synagogues read the Torah, they have a systematic way of reading it, and they start over on that day. That was the day that everything goes back to the beginning. And so we were looking at it, or I was looking at it as, when I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, and I stop and I turn.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like looking at like John Lennon's whole life as such, and the fact that John Lennon dies on December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And anyway, I like how you put George Harrison in black, and then you have Leslie Nielsen in white, like Sync Book 1 and Sync Book 2.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Oh, but, I guess I didn't even realize, but that's sort of how I was just playing off the opposites of the movie posters, because the 2001 poster is white and the 2010 poster is black.
That's cool.
Wow. Hey, guys, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to get going.
Oh, not a problem, man. I understand. This has been a real pleasure talking to you. We could do this through email or something, but you sent me an email saying you're going to be passing through. I'd love to get back together. It's been too long since I've seen you, man.
Yeah, definitely, man. Yeah, like early December, I'll be, you know, coming back through the city area. So I'd definitely love to, like, you know, get a date going for some dinner or something, you know.
Oh, wonderful.
I'd love to have you on the show again. I really
appreciate it. Yeah, that would be great.
Input
and yeah, really. I'd love to chat anytime. So, you know, just let me know anytime you guys are chatting it up, you know.
I wasn't sure I was still muted. Yeah, absolutely, Kev. Always a pleasure to talk to you. We'll make sure to have you back anytime you want.
Yeah, definitely, man. It was really, really great talking with you guys. I had a lot of fun.
Peace out, man.
Be well with it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, brothers.